Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. It was a busy week in the news with a new federal investigation into patronage at the state probation department.
Names were handed down to regional interview panels, despite their being not as qualified as other individuals.
City Councilor Chuck Turner expelled by his colleagues by an 11-1 vote.
James, Michael, forgive them. They know not what they do.
Two gang members sentenced for murder despite the prosecution's key witness pleading guilty to perjury.
And so you said that in front of the jury, correct?
Yes.
And was that true or false?
That was a lie.
And more Boston schools added to the list of those that Superintendent Carol Johnson wants to shut down, leaving many parents outraged.
At the end of the road, they will have many more empty seats than they have started with.
Including your child?
Absolutely.
You're taking your child out?
Absolutely. No questions about it now.
And we're going to talk about some of these top stories this week with Renee Loth, a columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Renee.
Thank you so much.
And also with David Buwari, who's a reporter here at WBUR. Hi, David.
Hi there, Sasha.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. We want to know what your big story from the week is, whether it was one of the ones we just mentioned or anything else that's been on your mind. Maybe one of your kids' schools is on the closing list. We want to know what you think about that. We wonder if you agree that Boston City Councilor Chuck Turner should have been expelled, or do you think he got a bum rap? And do you think the patronage scandal will be contained to the probation department, or do you think it will sprawl well beyond that? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also comment online at wbur.org/Boston. And again, we have Boston Globe columnist Renee Loth and WBUR reporter David Buwari today. David and Renee, let's start with those school closings, because there was a meeting last night at English High School, and many parents were outraged over the news that even more so-called underperforming schools are on the chopping block.
They didn't talk why. They just kept saying the money they put in each year, and they didn't see any advancements. Why are you closing the school?
Kids don't still have books. Where's the books?
Tell me about it.
Now, David and Renee, you both know that Carol Johnson has in the past backed off some of her more controversial proposals to close schools. There was specifically one a few years ago that was going to reduce the amount of busing that goes on in the city. And I wonder whether you feel like this time, is this the real and final list? What do the two of you have a sense? Have you covered this closely enough to know if you think that the schools on the list are schools that will close?
Well, you know, I didn't go to the meeting last night, but I spoke to a colleague who did and who went to the meeting a couple of weeks ago that was also very contentious. And he described last night's meeting as being really different in tone, and that the superintendent had brought with her entire management team, and they really had answers for the parents and the teachers, primarily teachers who were there, who were challenging her recommendations. You know, I think that she has backed off in the past. I think she may stick with it this time. She has to. You know, they're facing a major structural deficit. Many of the buildings are deteriorating. It's a very emotional thing, but I think, you know, that they've just come to the end of the road. And the question I really have is whether Mayor Menino will back his superintendent in her very politically unpopular position.
But it is the most emotional thing for parents. With schools. Absolutely. But you have a $63 million problem to match up against that emotional concern about the schools. And what she said last night, and I thought it was interesting, she said, we can't be successful if we have lots of buildings, but we can't give students a reason to come to schools and our parents a reason to choose us.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, if they have more charters, or as the mother we heard earlier in the show say, she says, now, finally, once and for all, I'm going to take my kid out of Boston Public Schools. So whether she goes private or whether she goes charter, could this end up having a counter effect of having more kids withdraw and the empty seats that they hope to reduce, we end up seeing more empty seats as a result?
Well, they're already projecting to lose 5,000 seats because of these new charters that are going to come in. And the reality is that the school population is declining and has been declining. It is an old system with lots of small schools and a declining population.
Yeah, there are just too many buildings. I mean, really, if you could have rolled the tape back several years, it might have been a good opportunity for something like a base closing commission, where there would be some, you know, apolitical expert group that would come in and make recommendations. But I think it's really too late for that now.
Your comment, Renee, about too many schools reminds me of the Catholic Church situation in Boston. Really, at point they realized we have too many churches in a way, too many big churches that are expensive to heat and not enough parishioners going. There seems to be this parallel with this facilities issue.
And it was interesting because Michael Ross, as well as Felix Arroyo, were talking about the library, saying, well,
exactly,
maybe we can do what we did with the libraries. The libraries were a $3 million problem. This is a $63 million
right.
problem.
And, of course, in the libraries, they've sort of backed off. I mean, this is also true of courthouses. There are
right.
just there are too many public facilities, and there need to be mergers or creative reuses of the buildings, especially the ones that are physically deteriorating and very costly.
We have a caller from Dorchester who wants to weigh in. And this is Gail from Dorchester. Gail, what's your thought about Carol Johnson, the superintendent's proposal to close more... Oh, I'm sorry, we lost that caller. I thought that was going to be a good caller, and we've lost her. So, you know, you're right. I think it's an interesting issue. There's so many comparisons to make here, courthouses, the church situation. Now, the charter school cap, Menino had spent many years opposing the lifting of it. You had mentioned the mayor, Renee. Is your sense that the mayor is finally saying, all right, maybe this has to happen?
Well, I mean, there's sort of two different issues there. One is the reuse of the buildings, or the structural deficit, and the other is charter schools. I think the charter school train has left the station, and you know, Mayor Menino is jumping onto the caboose. You know, I think that it's the right thing for him to be approving of more charter schools if there's a demand and if they're properly evaluated.
Let's talk about the Chuck Turner situation and more events there this week. This, of course, is the former, as of yesterday, former Boston City Councilor. Today, I believe he's expected to be clearing out of his
yeah,
city
it's
hall
effective
office.
Today.
Expected
so,
today.
Yes.
Exactly.
And I don't think anybody's going to be giving him shamrocks when he leaves City Hall.
No, although as reported this morning, some of his staffers did get $1,000 bonuses on the way out the door.
Although,
I don't know. Do you, the two of you, think a staffer should be penalized for, is a staffer
a
not due
practice.
$1,000 bonus?
It's a common practice by other counselors. It just so happens that he is one of them.
Yeah. I mean, Joe DiNucci, on his way out of the auditor's office, gave raises to his staff. I mean, it's kind of a parting gift. It's not doesn't outrage me that much.
But the thing with Chuck is a talker. Chuck, if anything, is a talker. He talked himself, according to his own lawyer, he talked himself into a conviction by taking the stand. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, all of Chuck's talk of recent hasn't helped him, and it hasn't helped his legacy, because there was no reason for that hearing this week.
Yeah.
That did not have to take place. He wanted it. He didn't have the votes for it. He forced them to open it up. He brought his crowd in. But most damaging, I think, he put two new promising city councilors, Felix Arroyo, a Hispanic, and Ayanna Pressley, an African-American, in a very difficult and embarrassing position where they voted against him and were called traitors, Judases, and Toms by hecklers in that audience.
Speaking of that talk, David, we have some sound of some of that talk this week. This is, of course, this deals with Turner having claimed that he was a victim of federal prosecutors who targeted him. And then he made this claim again to Morning Edition on the morning of the vote to oust him.
What is the morality of voting me off because I was convicted by a jury that was led by U.S. Attorney Sullivan attempt to pull me down?
And, of course, he compared himself to James Michael Curley, the famous, infamous late Boston mayor, who remained in office even after he had been convicted. I wonder if, for the two of you, did that comparison hold water at all?
Well, you know, I mean, Chuck Turner is revered in his community, and there are many people who think he was a terrific city councilor. But this sort of Marxist class analysis of, you know, his prosecution is just, you know, it's antique. I mean,
it was classic. It was vintage Chuck, though.
The idea that these, Irish, you know, second, third generation descendant Irish folks were going to identify with his oppression in some sort of, you know, pedagogy of the oppressed kind of moment is just, it's vintage Chuck Turner.
You know, historically, in part, he's right.
Of course.
Of course, the fact that the Boston's police commissioner was named by the state legislature until 1962. This goes to the Yankee-Irish conflict, to be sure. But, you know, it's always better to have somebody else call you a victim than to try and promote your victimhood.
Yeah.
He has a legitimate case, by the way, a complaint against Sullivan, the Justice Department, and the FBI for what happened to him. But in the course of this, he has made himself the center of attention. He's insulted, obviously, the Irish counselors. And to his own detriment, he's going to go before a judge now for sentencing who's heard him denying that he did anything wrong and accepting no responsibility.
We have a caller who wants to weigh in. This is Bill calling from Lincoln. And Bill, your thoughts on Chuck Turner?
I think you guys are in a nice way, kind of overdoing it. I mean, the guy took money. He's a crook. He spent the last 2-3 weeks rationalizing everything he's done. It's not that complicated. You know, it comes down to, you know, do we want to have people that represent us in office taking money on a regular basis? And it's just, I feel sorry for the guy, but, you know, at this point, he was dumb enough to get up and testify. He's probably going to spend some jail time. Like you said, the judge has heard all the things he said. He never said he was sorry. He never admitted it. To this day, he hasn't admitted it, even though we all know he did it. And it just, you know, you got to, at the very least, have a little remorse. He has zero remorse, and he really ought to go to jail.
Renee, any thoughts?
You know, I think that's a really good perspective. What's interesting to me looking forward is the dual sentences that will be coming down from Judge Woodlock, both for Chuck Turner and for Diane Wilkerson. You know, they have their crimes are not equivalent in the sense that Wilkerson pled guilty to taking much more money. But there's also been a big outpouring of support for her from many people, including Michael Dukakis and other, you know, good government type clean, you know, squeaky clean people who have called for mercy or leniency on the part of her sentencing. So how does the judge balance these two similar but, yeah, you know, distinct cases? It's going to be very interesting.
He is a heavy hitter, by the way. Just to add that, Doug Woodlock,
he's
the
excellent judge,
is a heavy hitter, heavy sentencer.
Yeah, but he's an excellent, I think, very fair judge. So it'll be interesting, though. He's got a real dilemma.
David Boyer, let's talk a bit about a story that you have been covering. It's another court case. It's basically a witness intimidation, witness perjury case. The basic outlines, and you can fill in the gaps for us, a murder case. 18-year-old killed in Roxbury back in 2007. Twice a jury deadlocks. Third time, finally, the jury comes back with a guilty plea. But this only happens after the prosecution has had to charge with perjury its key prosecution because she kept changing her testimony on the witness stand.
This is as dark a story as you can get. And I have a personal stake. I'm feeling this electricity in my spine as I tell you this because I was on the ambulance run that picked up Cedric Steele after he'd been shot 8 times in the chest.
He was 18 years old.
18 years old. He's delivering Meals on Wheels. The role he plays in his own murder is that he locked himself out of his car, and these two, according to all the testimony, were looking to kill somebody from the other neighborhood, anybody, and he was locked out of his car. It's as bad a story as you can imagine. The light at the end of it is that they took the witness who had been intimidated, threatened by her own boyfriend, who was one of the defendants, and the other defendant had plotted to kill her.
This witness is LaToya Thomas-Dixon,
That's
who you've
right.
been reporting on.
They indicted her, and through this extraordinary circumstances, two previous mistrials, they indicted her. She pled out at the same time the trial was going on, and the sentencing takes place after the trial. So she had every reason to tell the truth, and they actually succeeded because the jurors heard the stories of the threats against her and accepted that this time she was telling the truth.
And interestingly, this witness you're talking about, LaToya Thomas-Dixon, she admitted that she previously lied in court, although she said it was because she feared for her life after having been threatened and assaulted by her suspects.
And what threat does he make to you if you don't keep your mouth closed?
That he'll me up.
Did he'll you up?
Yes.
What does that mean to you?
It means he's going to me up.
And what does that mean?
Violence.
In other words, if she testifies correctly without lying, her own life is endangered in some way. I think it's very revealing, David, of what prosecutors are up against in so many ways. It's not just people who won't talk, but it's so many levels a problem.
Absolutely, of jurors that are threatened, jurors also who have distrust of the police, and in this case, it's just awful story. But by bringing her, indicting her, they sent a message they got her to testify. And then you would have thought, well, she's an admitted perjurer. They'll never win this one. The jurors were convinced on that story, on the basis of those threats to her, that, yes, she was telling the truth. They're hoping, obviously, the prosecution, Suffolk County, is hoping that this sends a message. Will it send a strong message? It certainly says they're serious, and you'd like to think there's light at the end of this day.
Is this young woman's life still in danger now that she finally has correctly testified?
Well, it's always, yeah, there's a concern, and she's going to be sentenced. And she'll probably do time for having lied at the second trial, which sends another message, although that's not as good a message as the conviction of the two gangbangers.
Renee, have you followed this? And I'm interested in your thoughts on, again, it's a window into what prosecutors are up against when they try to find people who are willing to tell the truth on the stand. And maybe not, it may not be for nefarious reasons that they don't want to testify correctly. And they're just frightened.
Right. And unlike in federal cases, they really don't have the resources to put witnesses in a witness protection plan. You know, they do have some, there is some money in the DA's office, I know, for, you know, to help witnesses, to protect them, to give them guards, to maybe, give them a bus ticket to Taunton or something. But, it's just not the same level of protection. And there was another case in the paper today of a similar kind of situation where the man who had been accused of stabbing Paul Pierce several years ago was convicted just yesterday of an attack, an assault, attempted murder charges against another witness, somebody who had been an informant for the prosecution. So, this goes on all the time in these communities, and it's just, very difficult to make a case.
And, the reality of this is here you have Cedric Steele, an honor student at Bunker Hill Community College, who was murdered that day. And the three, the witness Latoya Thomas-Dixon and the two defendants, all met each other in DYS, and they aged out. And one of the defendants at 17 was sent to Walpole. And you think, sending a 17-year-old to Walpole certainly puts him in the big leagues pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Before both of you go, at the end of the Week in Review on most Fridays, we do what we call our hubbub. This is one little item that somehow escaped most people's radar or that you just think is worth noting that may not have been noted much. Renee, do you want to start off?
Yeah. The local jazz artist, Esperanza Spalding, who teaches at Berkeley and who was a student there, was nominated for a Grammy this week for Best New Artist. This is really good news for lovers of music and of honest music. She tours with a string quartet. She hires some really terrific musicians in her band. And at a time when even the Rockettes are, getting rid of their live music, it's really wonderful to see this antidote to the kind of overproduced, electronic, market-driven, music that defines so much of our entertainment.
So when you
said
people who like honest music, it's the opposite of what you just described, the canned supermarket
music. That's right.
Music.
And yeah. Esperanza Spalding, good luck to her.
And David Boeri.
Well, it's all local, and hubbub for me is the deer hunting season in Petersham because it's put new light on stray dogs. There's a problem with dogs. Of course, my dog is on orange and day glow orange, making sure that no hunters shoot him in my backyard. But all owners of dogs are expected to keep them on leashes or at home because there's been a real problem there with dogs going after chickens.
Mm. Well, and I imagine it's also in the interest of the owners to be wearing the orange hats. I mean, if it's hunting season, everybody should be wearing orange.
You know
what the message is, I think.
There's something that always gives me a certain chill when I'm in my backyard and I see guys coming out of the woods with
guns. That's what you get for living out there in the Nowhereville. Move to the city, you'll be safer.
I have two mentions for my hubbub. The one is just a very short one. In Brookline tomorrow at Lars Anderson Park, there's this outdoor skating rink that's going to be named after this retired Brookline firefighter. He's 82. His name is Jack Corain. When he was a little kid, he skated on that pond, and then he went on to help the U.S. Olympic hockey team win the gold medal in 1960. And now 50 years later, he's getting this little rink named after him, which I thought was a sweet little story for Brookline.
That's fabulous.
I also want to mention that up in Salem is doing this little program. It's an amnesty program where if you have late fees on your traffic tickets, you can bring in two canned goods and you get your late fees waived. And now you still have to pay the original ticket. Now, of course, that's Salem. Now, in Boston, they have said that if you have a parking ticket, you can have that parking ticket forgiven if you bring in a toy for a needy kid. Now, as you pointed out, David, earlier, there's a little asterisk here. You want to tell us what that asterisk is?
That's right. The toys have to be worth more than the cost of the ticket.
Mm-hmm. Well, everything is more expensive in Boston.
It is.
You don't have to wear orange necessarily.
So for anyone who has a ticket and they want to quickly rush in with a toy, they have about an hour and a half left, I believe, because it ends at, I assume, 5 today. It's close of day Friday. Parking clerk, City Hall, or the Boston, or the BTD tow lot on Frontage Road, bring in a toy, your ticket goes away. Renee and David, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Same.
Renee Loth is a columnist for the Boston Globe, and David Bowery is a reporter for WBUR. Listeners, if you have other comments, you can post them online at wbur.org/Boston.